Welcome to Now You Know. I'm Catherine Sussman. Today, I'm speaking with the legendary Captain Paul Watson, one of the original founders of Greenpeace, founder, president, and executive director of Sea Shepherd, and recipient of many awards, including the Jules Verne Award dedicated to environmentalists and adventurers, as well as an inductee in the U.S. Animal Rights Hall of Fame for his outstanding contributions to animal liberation. A Toronto native, in 2000, Paul was named one of Time magazine's top 20 environmental heroes of the 20th century. He's certainly one of mine. Paul, it's such an honor to have the opportunity to talk with you today. Thank you so much for helping us get our little fledgling podcast off the ground. I really appreciate it. I was reading your bio and I came across a description, I think it was a self-description that you had put up somewhere, calling yourself an interventionist rather than a protester. And that really struck me as one of the key reasons that I admire you and what you've done for the world so much. The work that I do is I try to help get laws changed here in Canada. And even when that succeeds, more often than not, it's completely discouraging because the laws are not enforced. So the idea of acting as an interventionist, as somebody who steps into that gap and stands in for absent law enforcement is really heroic to me.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I've always felt that protesting is somewhat submissive. It's sort of like you're begging them to abide by the law or begging them to stop doing something that's reprehensible. When if it's illegal and it's reprehensible, then just intervene.
Well, most people don't have the courage to do that, so it's quite remarkable. For people listening who may not be familiar with Sea Shepherd, I was wondering if we could start with you just giving a bit of a rundown of the organization's mission and the current scale of its operations.
I established Sea Shepherd in 1977 as an interventionist group, an anti-poaching organization. It's now today a global movement, and we're in about 42 different countries. And we are involved in anti-poaching activities all around the world. Right now we have 14 ships that are active. We're doing anti-poaching patrols off of West Africa, East Africa, protecting the endangered Vaquita and Totoaba fish in the Sea of Cortez, doing anti-poaching patrols in the Mediterranean, you know, exposing the damage that fish farms are causing to indigenous salmon populations in British Columbia. One of our vessels is about to arrive in Iceland, where we're opposing the killing of fin whales, blue whales, and minke whales there. So what we are is still an all-volunteer organization. The crews come from 25 different countries. Right now, there's about 250 volunteers on the ships.
So I wanted to chat with you a bit about what's going on here this month in Canada federally, because you've probably been following it. I'm not sure. I don't know where you are right now and how busy you are, but we've just had the passage of multiple animal welfare bills, which is historic. It's really unprecedented. And in terms of marine life, we've had a couple of really massive wins. So the first thing was the passage of Bill S-203, the bill to end the captivity of whales and dolphins. And then just on last Tuesday, we had the passing of C-68, which was basically the government's overhaul of the Fisheries Act that rolled in a ban on the import and export of shark fins and other shark products. Would love to hear your thoughts on these new changes.
Well, they're very good things. You know, Elizabeth May, Camille Lapchuk, other people I know have been working on this for a long, long time. Rob Stewart, of course. So, yeah, it's great that Canada is the first country to really, as a country, ban shark fins. And also the cetacean captivity thing, although I don't think it's going to change anything for the dolphins that are presently in captivity. But it's certainly a big step forward. Of course, Canada's made no move at all on the seal hunt on the east coast of Canada, so something we've been battling for years and years. But I'm not going to be disappointed by the fact that they've done these two landmark bills despite the seal hunt.
Do you, I'm not sure, I haven't myself read every detail of Bill of C-68, which was the one that rolled in the banning of shark finning, imports and exports. But do you think that that goes far enough? I know that there are a lot of hidden uses of shark products. Like shark has multiple names, I think, in products. So I'm wondering if you know anything about how far this goes, but it's certainly, I guess, a good start.
Not at this point, but all government legislation has loopholes and
exactly
little hidden agendas.
Yeah. It was interesting because there was a bill that was not going to pass that had to do with single-use plastics. And the reason why the captivity of whales and dolphins bill passed was because an NDP MP, who this was his baby, single-use plastics, he gave up his hour since it wasn't going to pass. And now there's going to be a big movement among Liberals and NDPs to support single-use plastics. So that's like another big thing going on here, which is probably excellent news to you.
Well, I hope so. You know, Vermont has banned, where I'm living, has banned single-use plastic. Connecticut is looking at doing that right now. California, different places. It's got to happen. It just makes common sense. I mean, we're just polluting our ocean with plastic, microplastics, and, you know, the first step is get rid of single-use plastic. Second step, get rid of plastic altogether. Find alternatives to plastic.
So do you feel plastics, I'm wondering like what you feel are the most pressing issues regarding marine life, both from an animal welfare point of view and an environmental one?
Well, there's many, but of course, number one to me is the diminishment of biodiversity in the world's oceans, primarily because overfishing, illegal fishing, you know, just clear-cutting all life out of oceanic ecosystems. So that's my first concern. Plastic is a very imminent threat also. Microplastics are now ingested by pretty much everything that lives in the sea and by people who eat seafood. They're finding microplastics in zooplankton. They're finding it's actually falling in the rain as it recently did in the Pyrenees. And every beach in the world is polluted with it. And it's going to, you know, going to take eons to clean it up. Eventually, some bacteria is going to evolve that can eat it and get rid of it. But that's not going to help us in the present. Of course, we also have Fukushima, which nobody talks about, and the radiation that every day is spewing into the North Pacific, 500 tons a day. Oh. And there's a media blackout on that for some reason. Sonic pollution, which is having a devastating impact upon cetaceans and other marine wildlife. Acidification, climate change, all of these things together are literally pointing towards the death of our ocean. I always say, if the ocean dies, we all die.
It's interesting because I'm mentioning all this good news that we've had in Ottawa this month, but then at the same time, I don't know if you heard, but Trudeau has approved the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion, and that's set to begin sometime before the end of this year. So I guess that has the potential to completely more than wipe out all the good that with these other, some of them symbolic pieces of legislation that have just passed.
Well, Canada's biggest sin right now is the destruction of the fisheries, both on the east and the west coast. What they're doing with salmon farms, supporting the salmon farms and the transmission of viruses and parasites to 7 indigenous wild salmon populations from these fish farms, basically because they've introduced an exotic predator which has no right to be in that ecosystem. I mean, if you or I were to put a piranha in, say, in a lake, that would be a criminal offense. So I don't understand how they can put an exotic predator into an ecosystem that doesn't belong, but the Canadian government supports that. We've won numerous cases against the Canadian government, but they simply just ignore the court rulings and carry on and ignore the fact that these viruses being spread. The recent court ruling was that they had to do this. They say they are doing it, but you know, our vessel, the Martin Sheen, came a week ago into Victoria and immediately got harassed by the government, told that we could only stay there for 30 days at a time because our objective is to monitor what the Canadian government is doing and if they're actually doing any of these testing. And they don't, to me, if they do the testing, my belief on this is that they're not going to find anything because they don't want to find anything.
So do you believe that the overhauling of the Fisheries Act will have any positive impact in terms of mitigating some of that? Or I guess you haven't looked at that in detail. I haven't myself, but it's supposed to, you know, be like a wonderful kind of refurbishment of the old act.
All talk. The Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans is the single most incompetent and irresponsible bureaucracy in the Canadian government. It always has been. You know, from the collapse of the cod fishery to what they're doing with the salmon, to the fact that they destroyed all of the archives of the fisheries and all of the research that's been done for 100 years. They literally destroyed it so that we would no longer have access to it. And that means no longer have access to their record of incompetence. So the fact is that Canada gives this image to the world that, you know, it's very progressive. But the reality of it is simply not. It is a government that is dictated by the corporations.
So backtracking a little bit, I would love just to ask you about the seal hunt, the Arctic seal hunt for a minute. I mean, this is something that you started, I believe, in like the mid-70s. And can you just summarize for us the situation with the commercial seal hunt? Why is this something that never changes when so many people have worked so hard over the years? Is this going to go on forever?
Well, it's political. The Canadian government knows worried about losing boats in Newfoundland. It's a glorified welfare scheme. It certainly hasn't made any money for anybody for decades. We managed to shut it down in the mid-80s by getting Europe to ban white coat pelts, and then it revived again in the 90s. And then in 2008, we were able to get the European Union to ban all seal products from Canada. And there really isn't a market for seal pelts, but it continues to exist because of massive subsidies by the Canadian government to pay these people to go out and kill seals for something that has absolutely no commercial value. And then, of course, they confuse the public, the international public and the Canadian public, by saying that this is an assault on Inuit people and Aboriginal people. And, of course, they've gone into these communities and paid a lot of money to have the Inuit communities ally themselves with commercial seal hunt. Nobody has ever opposed the Inuit hunting of 10,000 harp seals every year in the north of Canada. Seals, of course, they never take that many, maybe 50, 60,000. So that means that they can kill as many as they want because it's an unlimited quota. They already know, the Canadian Department of Fisheries knows, that there's no impact on fish populations from harp seal populations. In fact, the science shows that if you want a healthy fish population, you need a healthy seal population. You know, in 1535, when Jacques Cartier first came over to Canada, you know, he threw a basket, a wicker basket, into the Gulf of St. Lawrence and come up with codfish. At the turn of the century, there the average length of a northern cod was about 1 meter. Now it's about 18 inches. And at that time, there were 45 million seals in the North Atlantic. So with 45 million seals, there was certainly no shortage of codfish. And then suddenly, with seal populations being around 10% of their original number, they're blaming the seals for the demise of cod. We all know it was Canadian and Norwegian and Spanish fisheries that destroyed it.
So I was reading that it's Norway that is the largest purchaser of seal products. What are the products exactly? Like, what are they buying them for?
Norwegians have always been behind it. You know, even the Canadian companies, Carlson was a Norwegian company. Over the years, seals have been killed for various reasons. In the early years, it was for the fat, which was used for everything from margarine to weapons to making explosives. Then, of course, it went for the fur industry, and leather was another thing. But there's really, the demand really isn't there. It's very limited. Canada tried to create markets in China and Russia, and that failed. They've spent an incredible amount of money trying to get other countries to buy it or to lobby the European Union and the United States to lift the ban on seal pelts. But there really is no future for this industry. It's a dead industry. And the only reason it survives is because Canada pays huge amounts of money to keep it going.
So is this something that you think will just eventually fade out? Or is this something that Sea Shepherd will be involved in the future?
The reason Sea Shepherd's not involved with the seal hunt is that the Canadian government and the Canadian Sealers Association would love nothing better than for us to be involved, because that would fire up their passions and it'll be once more us up against versus them, and we'll be actually throwing gasoline on the fire. So we're hoping by not being involved then that it'll die out, that they'll lose interest, because they're not making any money on it. And like I said, it only exists because of these massive government subsidies. Now, if it was any other company or corporation or whatever, and it's not making a profit, it would die. It would die under its own demise, under its the fact that it's not making any money. But so these things are just glorified welfare systems.
So switching topics, I'm wondering if you could just update us. How is the world doing now when it comes to the protection of wild whales? Are there species that have come back? Are there other species? Can you just outline the ones that are most at threat right now?
All whaling, commercial whaling, has been eliminated from pelagic waters. Japan has retreated from the Southern Ocean and won't be returning. So all whaling now is restricted to the territorial waters of Japan, Iceland, Norway, and Denmark, which is incredible. There's no whaling in the entire Southern Hemisphere also. So this is great. The Japanese are withdrawing from the International Whaling Commission, which is good news. It allowed the International Whaling Commission to create the Southern Atlantic Whale Sanctuary, which Japan has been blocking for years. So whales are doing really good in that respect. Humpback whale populations are recovering. Right whale populations, not so much. Their primary threat is ship strikes on both the east coast of North America in various places in the world, and especially off Argentina. And of course, the other problem threatening whales is sonic pollution from fracking, from military testing, and plastic pollution. All of these things are having an impact upon whale populations. But things have changed considerably for the better over the last few years when it comes to stopping the commercial hunting of whales.
And could you just answer that also in regard to shark finning for this horrible practice that's occurring? I mean, Canada's now passed this legislation, but most of the world, I mean, probably hasn't. Could you just update listeners on that a little bit, where we need to go from here and how dire that situation might be?
There's not a big market for shark meat, but there's a huge market for shark fins. So that's why they go out and they just cut fins off and throw the rest of the bodies back into the ocean. And those fins are primarily sold in China. And the problem is that people all over the world are providing that market. It's good that Canada is no longer doing that, but the Spanish, the Chinese, the Taiwanese, the Russians, God, everybody go. Every time we go out anywhere after poachers, we see them drying shark fins. It's estimated about anywhere from 100 to 150 million sharks are killed every year for the shark fin trade.
And it's just such a brutal, inhumane, horrific thing to hear about. I was reading an article today about how they're impaled on metal hooks, this is a quote, dragged onto bloody boat decks where their fins are sliced off and while still conscious are tossed into the ocean to sink to the bottom, bleeding out and suffocating. Pretty gruesome.
Were incredibly monstrous in comparison to the sharks. And shark attacks are usually a case of mistaken identity because unfortunately surfers tend to look like seals from underneath. But you know, one of the interesting things that I've discovered on shark attacks is the three places in the world where shark attacks are the most prevalent are Queensland, Western Australia, and La Reunion Island in the Indian Ocean. And what do these three places all have in common? They have shark cull programs. In other words, they kill sharks. And what happens there is when you start killing sharks, you create a vacuum that brings in more sharks. And those new sharks are very territorial because they're trying to establish their territory in that new territory and much more aggressive. So I believe that the shark cull programs are actually creating a lot of the shark attacks that we're seeing in those three locations.
Wow, that's pretty fascinating. So for our show, the purpose of our show is what we do is we interview experts like you and then we put together a little kind of fun show that we come up with a simple message of change, like an action that a person can take if they're not an animal activist, if they're not into this kind of stuff at all, but they want to help make the world a better place, help animals, help the environment. And then we take that message and we challenge a celebrity to tweet it out for us and call attention to the issue. So given all the stuff we've been talking about, do you have any ideas? What do you think would be a great simple action message that the average person can take? Like if you don't have like tons of money, if you don't have a lot of time, what are simple things that we can do to help the ocean and to help animals, marine animals?
Most constructive thing is to adopt a vegan or vegetarian diet or at least don't eat seafood. And that'll go a long way. You know, strangely enough, when people eat meat, they're actually eating fish because 40% of all the fish that is taken is converted into fish meal, which is fed to chickens and to pigs and domestic salmon and various other animals. So, you know, we live in a world right now where factory farm chickens are eating more fish than all the world's puffins and albatrosses put together.
I did not know that.
So
wow.
This is where we can really make a difference, you know, and veganism, vegetarianism are very growing movements.
Is there anything else that you recommend, like maybe to do with the use of plastics or any other direct action we can take?
Yeah, working to, of course, end this single use of plastic. Also, when people go to the beach, they should be very aware of the kind of suntan lotion that they're using to make sure it's not one that is toxic and killing coral reefs, which has been a real problem in places like Florida and Hawaii. And so, you know, really looking at what your personal footprint is when it comes to the ocean and becoming more and more aware of the ocean. for most people, the ocean is out of sight and out of mind. But the fact is that it is the life, and you know, it's the life support system of the planet. As if the ocean dies, we die. You know, if phytoplankton were to disappear tomorrow, we would all die. We cannot live on a planet without phytoplankton. It produces 70% of the oxygen we breathe. And since 1950, there's been a 40% diminishment in phytoplankton populations around the world. That can't get, and most people aren't even aware of what phytoplankton is.
How did oceans become your passion?
It was a realization that the ocean is the life support system of the planet. And also an understanding, I try to get people to understand just what the ocean is. You know, because everybody thinks of the ocean as the sea. But the ocean is the planet. It is, in fact, the entire planet. The ocean is us. It is water in continuous circulation from the sea into ice and underground in the atmosphere and in the cells of every living plant and animal. The ocean is constantly passing through all of us. And that circulation is what brings life to this planet. So we are the ocean. So really, this is a movement for self-preservation.
Wow, that is so beautiful and so profound. Is there anything else you'd like to say or chat about? Anything I haven't asked you about that is important to you that you'd like to talk about before we go?
Well, one of the things that Sea Shepherd's done over the last 2 years is to build partnerships with various governments around the world. So now we have partnerships in Africa with Benin and Gabon, with Ghana, with San Tome, with Tanzania, with Namibia and Cape Verde. And what we do with these governments is that we do poaching patrols in their waters, carrying their enforcement people. So we provide the resources, they provide the enforcement, which is allowing us to stop, you know, hundreds of poachers on the high seas. Our partnership with Mexico allows us to patrol the Sea of Cortez and to confiscate poaching nets. We've taken 950 nets out of the refuge in the last 5 years. And this, I believe that if it wasn't for our Operation Milagro in Mexican waters, the vaquita would now be extinct. And it's been a very effective campaign. We also have partnerships with Costa Rica and Peru, and also and in Ecuador since 2000, it'd be 19 years now, we've been working with the Galapagos National Park. We've set up AIS systems to monitor all ship traffic in and out of national park waters. We've, trained a canine unit, and we take care of that canine unit. They work with the Ecuadorian police to stop wildlife trafficking in and out of the Galapagos Islands. We've provided patrol boats, and we provide legal assistance to the national park itself. It's been a very, very effective campaign for the last two decades. So I don't think there's any other NGO that actually is doing that kind of work, which is like a partnership with established governments that don't have the resources to uphold their own law.
That's absolutely phenomenal. So if people want to get involved with Sea Shepherd, should they go to your website? What is the best way to do that?
Yes, people can be involved in many ways, as shore volunteers or as crew members on board the vessels, and the crew applications and the shore applications are on our website. And of course, people can support us by becoming financial supporters of the organization. We are the largest non-government Navy in the world, conservation Navy in the world, and we have 14 ships out on the oceans, and those are expensive. So, you know, anything people can do to help us support those ships goes a long ways.
I just saw a picture of the Bridget Bardot.
We do a lot on very little.
Yeah, it looked pretty cool.
That boat was originally built as, it had a really unromantic name, of the Cable and Wireless, because 20 years ago it set the world record for circumnavigation of the globe.
Wow.
And after they did that, they did, you know, they just picked it up very, very cheaply. We're working in partnership with the Bridget Bardot Foundation to run that vessel.
Well, thank you for everything that you do. And thank you so much for taking the time for a little, you know, fledgling cause like this one. So I really appreciate it, Paul. It was really wonderful to chat with you.